I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Religion professor Anthea Butler asked this critical question in her new book, White Evangelical Racism. Why do so many white evangelical Christians support policies and politicians who are the antithesis of basic Christian values and the message and meaning of Jesus Christ? She cites the defense of slavery, Jim Crow, segregation, and tax policies that favor the rich, and opposition to civil rights and LGBTQ legislation and immigration. Why, for instance, did so many white evangelical voters embrace birtherism and support Donald Trump, who bragged about his wealth and belittled the less fortunate? Professor Butler says that racism is embedded in evangelicalism and that too many followers have embraced political power at the expense of their religious faith. Claims about the moral majority, she says, are more about preserving white supremacy than living a moral life. Anthea Butler is the Geraldine R. Siegel Professor of American Social Thought at the University of Pennsylvania, where she's also chair of religious studies. And Anthea Butler, sitting across from me, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Great to be here.
Well, you have written a firecracker of a book here. So let's start with you, actually. You have a couple of sentences in this book about your own religious upbringing and kind of where you are today. Tell us about how you were raised.
Well, I was raised Roman Catholic in Texas, and after having moved to Los Angeles, became an evangelical Christian and decided to go to the premier evangelical seminary, which I know is going to drive everybody crazy right now, Fuller Seminary. And when I was at Fuller Seminary, there was a big event that happened, and that was the 1992 riots right before I entered.
And
Rodney King verdict. And that was a very, you know, personal moment for me and how we had to deal with race on that campus at that seminary. So for me, this has been sort of a backdrop to all this kind of education that I've had, first at seminary and then at doing my PhD work at Vanderbilt. So for me, you know, being an evangelical was this moment of, oh, this is great. You know, you have a relationship with God. But then you realize the people you have a relationship with who are supposed to be the people of God are not really that nice all the time. And that is a problem. And the ways in which evangelicals talk about race and racism are, oh, you know, well, we need to get along and God doesn't see color and we're all one in Jesus Christ. And I'm like, but you don't treat everybody that way. And so the moment for me that I came to in the book was a moment where the church that I went to did a Love LA kind of thing right after the riots or insurrection, however you want to call it. And I'm sitting there next to the pastor's mother. And we had a black church that came and another Presbyterian church that came. People who know LA will know which churches I'm talking about, as I'm being oblique for a reason. And she turned to me. I had been very involved in the church. And she says, "Welcome to blank church." And I'm like, "For real? You know who I am. I have been here." But because I was there with a black congregation in the midst of this predominantly white congregation, I automatically got coded as, "You must belong to that bad black Baptist church instead of us." And so that was the moment that I realized, like, they don't see me. They see me as this color person, you know, and I'm using colored right here because that's probably what she was thinking, unfortunately. And It was this moment of realization. And so as I went through my education and teaching this subject of evangelicalism, I realized that for evangelicals, race is this sticky point. It is a moment where they either sink into the mud or they try to glorify themselves through this history about, well, we were abolitionists, we did missionary work, we did all this stuff, but nobody wanted to look at this other history. And so when we got to Donald Trump, everybody's like, "Well, I don't understand why evangelicals are for Donald Trump." And I'm like, "I exactly understand why they are." And that was the moment for me. And I started thinking about what this book might look like. So, yeah.
Well, we will get to Donald Trump, but I want to begin more at the beginning and also even a definition, because to be honest with you, I Googled evangelicalism just to make sure I knew it. You know, where are we actually talking about it? What does it mean to be an evangelical?
Well, you know, I'm going to quote George Marsden, who's an evangelical historian, who said, "An evangelical is anybody who likes Billy Graham." Now, most of my students don't know who the hell Billy Graham is. is now. They know who Franklin Graham is. So I don't think that works. But I want to talk about that in a couple of ways. And I talk about this at the top of the book. One of the things I say is that, you know, there's a theological definition. So evangelicals like to define themselves through what we call the Bevington Quadrilateral. That means, you know, belief in the Bible, you know, crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus Christ, you know, atonement, all of those kind of things, right? So that's one way you want to think about it theologically. There's kind of a, you know, a cultural definition. Oh, these are people who are not in these kind of traditional mainline churches like Presbyterians or, you know, Episcopalians. They exist in denominations like, you know, Christian Reformed, you know, non-denominational churches, things like that. Or they came out of fundamentalism, right, which is a whole nother thing that we could talk about later and which I cover in the book. But the way that I wanted to think about it is to break it down in centuries. And so I'm going to talk about this from the book just very quickly and say, in the 19th century, the term evangelical was about missionary work, spreading the gospel to the heathen, read ethnic groups other than white, and was embraced by people who were for and against slavery. In the 20th century, evangelicalism became a term that was used internally as a boundary-making enterprise to wall off evangelicals who embraced an identity different than fundamentalists. And then, you know, we get to the 1970s, and then evangelicals are those born-again people like the classic Time magazine cover, and that's where we've been up to now.
Well, let's go back even to the Civil War.
Sure.
And the justification among, and I'm assuming Christians even beyond evangelicals in the 19th century, the justification for slavery.
Yes.
You have a couple of quotes, Genesis, the Ephesians, some quotes that were used to justify, using the Bible, to justify the enslavement of black people.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we think it, you know, we talk about Philemon in the New Testament. They would say, oh, you know, look, Philemon was a, you know, it's a great moment. You know, Onesimus was a slave. He came back to his master. This is great. Slaves, be obedient to your masters. You know, this is kind of a hierarchical way of thinking, right? And evangelicalism is all about hierarchy, right? Or you look at, you know, stories about slavery in the Old Testament. One is, of course, the curse of Ham, which, you know, Noah is drunk and his sons try to not look at his nakedness, but Ham does. And this is how people talk about the curse of Ham. So Ham must be Hamitic people, African people who are destined to be slaves because of this. Okay. And I sort of expand on this in the book. So, you know, I start that chapter off with the interesting story that happened while I was writing the book. And let's just say that there are a lot of people still in America who believe that, you know, oh, this is right. You know, slavery was a good thing. This was a way that black people got, you know, Christianity. And if it hadn't been for slavery, this is the way it is. And I'm thinking, this is the craziest thing I have ever heard in my entire life. But it is a sincerely held belief by a lot of people in this country.
Well, there's even, I believe you write in this book, there was even when Bibles were given to enslaved people, the chapter Exodus was removed.
Yes.
And obviously Exodus is the, you know, ability to sort of lead.
To lead people out of Egypt and slavery. This is, you know, your whole story of Moses, right? But you take that out. I mean, and so, you know, this has to be thought because people don't even have that many Bibles then. But to leave that out, you know, to say this is story is not there. But, you know, the thing about it is that for the enslaved, they really understood when they heard these stories, they put themselves in this story. And so that Exodus story, when they heard it, it was like, God's going to free us too.
Mm.
So I think, you know, this is where we have to start to understand that the teaching about slavery and Christianity in America are crucial to understanding where things are right now. We cannot leave the 19th century or the 18th century behind in order to deal with 21st century kinds of issues without understanding why we are the way we are.
Because obviously the justification of slavery was about power.
Absolutely.
And wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And being it sort of largely sort of in control of the country.
Well, yes. And this is the thing. I mean, you know, and I think for most people, and because we're here in Philadelphia, which was both, you know, slave and free to hear people here in Philadelphia, I think it's important for people to understand that this is not just a Southern thing. It was an American thing. And the American thing means that, you know, even if you had to have free states, there were people in those free states who thought, well, you know, we could just send those slaves back. Well, you know, if they run away and come up here, we can just, you know, let slave catchers come and bring them back down the plantations and wherever they, you know, the person that they belonged to, and I put that in quotation marks. So this is not something that is just a Southern thing. This whole idea about slavery and religion and everything is an American thing. And when you get to the Civil War and you're fighting this battle, you begin to see how, you know, the lines sort of lay out in terms of religion, religiosity, how people think about this, and why things, you know, have this little, there's a little window of time where things are okay, and then everything goes to hell all over again.
Well, you know, it got me thinking about critical race theory. We apply that more to sort of political ideas and ideologies, but when you think about, you know, religion as a justification for slavery, it raises questions about critical race theory.
Well, yeah, and it also raises questions about how critical race theory is being used as a bludgeon right now to not be able to teach what people, what students need to understand in America right now. I mean, I think this whole canard about critical race theory is being bad is the fact that people just don't want to feel bad about the history of their nation, first of all, and secondarily, they don't want to feel bad about their whiteness and what that might mean. And, you know, students always say something in class like this. They'll say, well, you know, I wasn't involved in that, but yeah, that's not the point. The point is that this is part of our history and we need to understand it and learn it. So this maelstrom that we are in right now, this idea in which, you know, evangelicals don't want to have anybody teach critical race theory or, you know, they're yelling about the 1619 Project or whatever. I'm like, what they don't want to see is that this is who they are. And when you have to grapple with who you are and what your roots are and not lean into a false hagiographic, lovely history of how you want to remember yourself as opposed to what really happened, that means that you don't face the realities of where we are today.
We're almost up in a break here, but do you put this in the lap of evangelicals uniquely, or is it... is it beyond that?
It's beyond that, but I put it in the lap of evangelicals because evangelicals have the most, I would say, false naivete about who they've been. And that false naivete has been built up by a lot of their historians. And there's a whole group of us now who are, you know, historians who have connections to evangelicalism, who have been writing about evangelicals and talking about the ways in which this kind of religion has made things difficult for us in the country because of their relationship to the Republican Party and power. And I think that now what we have to deal with and what evangelicals have to grapple with is that, you know, it's not just a history of, you know, wringing hands over about what has happened in the last 6 to 8 years. It's about wringing your hands over the last 200 to 400 years about who they have been and what part they have played, not just in America, but around the world in making things, you know, how should I put it, in a nice way, poisonous for other people of other religions and races.
That is our guest, Professor Anthea Butler. She's got a new book. It's called White Evangelical Racism, and it's subtitled The Politics of Morality in America. And she's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. We, of course, want to hear from you, especially if you are evangelical. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can do it the old-fashioned way. You can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We do want to hear from you, and do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Again, talking with Anthea Butler about her new book, White Evangelical Racism. I do want to move ahead, but I do want to quote Frederick Douglass, whom you quote in this book, and he said, "For all the slaveholders I have met, religious slaveholders are the worst. I have found them to be the meanest and basest, the most cruel and cowardly of all others."
Well,
what does that tell us?
Well, it tells us a lot. It tells us about, you know, the experience, first of all, Frederick Douglass had of watching, you know, a religious clergy member beat a woman, you know, almost to death and, you know, get up and preach on Sunday like nothing happened. That's number one. But I think what he meant at that time is that they used religion in such a way to justify cruelty. And that, to me, speaks a lot to where we are right now, because there's a lot of cruelty that is happening today in terms of how evangelicals see the world, whether they're talking about, you know, we don't want immigrants here. You know, Jesus was for the stranger. They're like, you know, screw the stranger. We don't want this person here. We need to, you know, seal our borders. Whether that's about God and guns, as we've seen lots in some of these pictures that have been on Christmas cards, you know, right? You know, how do you have, you know, the birth of Jesus and guns is beyond me, but okay. Right. If we talk about the ways in which, you know, evangelicals have sort of, you know, eschewed the kinds of ways in which it used to be a culture of giving, and now it's a culture of I need to receive and nobody else needs to receive anything, you know, and not caring for people, especially not taking vaccines, and we'll get there soon or later. You know, there's all of these things, right? And so I think that Frederick Douglass points to something that, to me, and what I've done in this book, trying to show it through history, is endemic about how evangelicals see the world and their use of morality, the use of morality to propose these ideas that are inherently cruel at times to how people really should be treating each other.
Well, I do want to move through, I mean, just to touch briefly on Jim Crow, Reconstruction, the KKK. You have examples, and I mean, they're out there. They're examples of how these terrorist organizations, for lack of a better word, for KKK, you know, had the support of so many Christians.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I think people don't realize how much the KKK, you know, put themselves forward as a Christian organization. I, you know, there's a great book by Kelly Baker on this about the KKK, and if you tweet at me, I will send it to you. She writes and tells this whole story about Christianity and the KKK, and you begin to see how, whether that's the White League early on, the reiteration of the KKK in 1950s forward with somebody who's a former pastor, okay? This is where we get to see how these things about law and order and religion come together. In other words, I like to call it like this. It's like, it's not enough to punish Jesus on the cross. You have to continually punish people in evangelicalism in order to make them pay for whatever sins you think that they did and the sin that you already have.
Well, that gets us to Billy Graham, to Jerry Falwell, and to, you know, more recent history. How do you see Billy Graham? He's such a, I don't know, enigmatic, maybe not enigmatic isn't quite the right word, but you expose, you know, his...
Billy Graham's complicated, and he's complicated because on the one hand, everybody wants to revere him as a great, you know, evangelist, somebody who just wanted people to be saved. But the reality is, you know, Billy Graham joined W.A. Criswell's church in 1953, which was, you know, First Baptist Church of Dallas, which is one of the most racist churches ever. W.A. Criswell was an avowed racist, you know, did not apologize for it. That's in 1953. This man is from South Carolina. Why is he joining a church in Texas? Okay, because you identify with the beliefs of this church. And so you have these moments where Billy Graham says, you know, I want all people to come together. You know, he has, you know, integrated meetings, but he also has segregated meetings, right? This is the conundrum for lots of, you know, evangelists during this time period, but Billy Graham happens to be the big one. And then you see, you know, and I will talk about this because I think it's, you know, the classic picture for me that gets in my head is a Bible museum in D.C. They have, in the 20th century, they have a picture of Billy Graham looking at Martin Luther King as though they are the two people who brought together, you know, integration and solved the racial problem. Like, nothing could be further from the truth. Billy Graham allows Martin Luther King to come and do the prayer at Madison Square Garden in 1956 when he has his prayer thing. But the very next year, when King appeals to him not to go on stage with Governor Price Jones, who's in Texas, right? He says, yeah, I'm going to ignore that. I'm going to get on stage with this racist guy. You know, and he just he ignores all the pleas from all these black clergy members about getting on stage with this avowed, you know, Texas governor who's a racist. Right. So, I mean, you can see throughout Billy Graham's career that, you know, he's trying to make this change. And so when we finally see towards the end of, you know, this 1960s, he begins to walk into what I call, you know, this colorblind thing where he has people like, you know, Andre Crouch and others, you know, sing and do things at his crusades, right? So it's always, I call it the black sidekick thing. You know, evangelicals always have a black sidekick, so it makes it look like, we're not racist. Look, we got this black person on the stage with them. And it's this moment in which they're having to sort of recapitulate and think about, you know, the culture is changing. We need to change with the culture. But the fact of the matter is that Billy Graham is not on the forefront of trying to fight against, you know, racism. In his classic phrase that he says, and I'm going to paraphrase, it's in the book, where he talks about, you know, little black boys and little white girls will never walk hand in hand until they get to heaven. Clearly for him, you don't do this, you don't fight for this in the ways that King and other civil rights members were fighting for this. He's like, you know, you're being against the law in society. This is what he used as the way, the excuse to say that there should not be marches, there should not be sit-ins, there should not be anything. And this is a classic thing that evangelicals still use today as a way to say we shouldn't have Black Lives Matter, we shouldn't have people marching in the street, you shouldn't be fighting, that you should try to just do this through the courts or do this, you know, through the ways in which you can do this through your congressperson and everything. But if the power base and structure is white male, how do you do this?
Let me throw something else in, and I'm just thinking of Billy Graham, but also his relationship with Richard Nixon. And
yes,
you begin to see this melding of religion, or I guess evangelical religion, and politics, and then, of course, the Republican Party.
Yeah.
How did that happen? How did that get
that
cemented?
Friendship, well, you know, you have to sort of think about, even before Nixon, how, you know, Graham started off trying to court different presidents, and he's trying to court Truman, and Truman doesn't have anything to do with him. And then he gets to Eisenhower, and Eisenhower, of course, says yes. So, you know, let's think about this sort of political way that Billy Graham puts it in. I think a lot of us need to really reframe how we look at Billy Graham and say, this is the man who made it easy for evangelicals and other religious people to come into politics. Because what does he have? He has, you know, we start off with the National Day of Prayer. He's praying on the Capitol steps in, you know, in 1952. He begins this friendship with Nixon and then tries to make sure that Nixon's going to win by, you know, letting Norman Vincent Peale be the fall guy for his, you know, his way of trying to subvert that election to make it swing for Nixon when, you know, the reality happens is JFK. You know, his friendship with Nixon that continues on in 1968 forward when Nixon wins, you know, ends up with him being on tape talking about Jews in a very terrible way. But it also ends up in this, you know, Make America Day that happens that he wants to do in order to help support Nixon that ends up turning into a riot. And I think that people need to really look at Graham in this way that he is not just an evangelical leader, but a political leader. Because this is the key. And I really think that he is the hinge where all of this lies. I mean, had it not been for Graham, maybe evangelicals might not have been as political, or they might have been underground more politically than they were. But Graham made it, you know, acceptable to be political and out in public.
Is it also that then things like busing and segregation and, you know, separate bathrooms becomes more important than spreading the gospel, than spreading the word of Jesus?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, what becomes more important, and this is the way I like to put it, is to think about, you know, where you have Plessy versus Ferguson in the 19th century into the 20th, what becomes what the cultural norm is more important for evangelicals to believe in than what would actually be the right thing to do. So when we talk about busing and all of this, you know, I get into these the issue of about Christian academies and how those things work as a way to hide your kids away from integration, right? And that people don't really quite realize how long it takes for Brown versus Board to really come to fruition and to talk about busing and all of this thing. And all of these things have religious connotations because when you have white citizens councils everywhere in the South, you know, supporting this and putting up posters on there. I have my students do this exercise. I'm sorry I'm jumping, but one of the exercises I have them do is to look through the white citizen council files and find me cartoons and editorials that show clergy members. And invariably, what you get are, you know, liberal Protestants, you know, trying to force integration and that, you know, some Southern preacher is preaching against it. And, you know, we shouldn't let these people, carpetbaggers, right, come in and change our world and change how we teach. So when you get to Bob Jones and their problems with the IRS in the early 1970s, what people need to understand is this is not just about abortion. It's about how they are fighting integration in schools and how they are fighting and to keep that away from that college, from, you know, regular academies. And you still have these segregation academies all throughout the South. They just look like nice Christian schools.
Well, and just to underscore what you're saying there is that it was about losing tax exempt status. So then you go from the gospel to the tax code.
Yes, exactly. And when the tax code gets on the gospel and says you need to follow the law, i.e. you need to be open to everyone and take applications from everyone, they're like, no. And this is how the mobilization begins. You know, abortion starts off as this kind of interesting way to pull everybody in. And you have to thank Paul Weyrich for all of that in the 1970s for, you know, bringing these kind of disparate groups together. By the way, a Catholic. So there's a Catholic story embedded in here, too, kind of underneath everything. But I think that it's very it's easy for people to think now, well, this has all been about abortion. This was about a moral issue, right? But what I wanted to show in this book was the moral issues drove the political issues. So moral issues were a way to crack the door open on politics and to use that as a way to both protect evangelicals from intense scrutiny, but at the same time to allow them to have control over the broader public.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. We got some comments here. I want to make sure that we get in on our, get as part of the conversation. Anthea Butler is our guest, and her book is White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America. And again, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call. Phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Patty comments, Southern white evangelicals who supported white supremacy and slavery and based it on scriptures pass those beliefs down through generations in their families. In my opinion, Falwell Jr. and Graham carry on that legacy. They just have to be sly about saying it. Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't know if they're very sly about saying it. I think they just say it. Honestly, I mean, let's talk about Franklin Graham for a minute, who was a big proponent of birtherism. I mean, I don't think there's anything sly about that. And as far as Jerry Falwell Jr. goes, well, you know, he's got lawsuits against the Liberty University, and Liberty University is suing him. So the very university that his father founded is now suing him for all kinds of issues, including moral ones. And so I think that's really interesting to sort of think about that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And so while people used to say that, oh, Franklin Graham, this is terrible. It's not like Billy. I'm like, yeah, maybe he's more like Billy than you think he might be.
Well, let me ask you about birtherism. I mean, I always felt like that was code for the N-word. I mean, it was just instead of saying that, you called the president, former President Obama, a birther. But it's also interesting, and we should underscore that by saying candidate Trump, was probably the biggest birther of them all. I was looking at some interesting surveys, looking at evangelicals and the Republican Party and former President Trump, and he still holds on to a sizable portion. In fact, the number of white evangelicals that support Donald Trump greater now than in 2016.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he's King Cyrus to them. He is the king that bought them out and got them everything. And let me just say something that is going to make everybody crazy on here who listens to politics. Donald Trump was the best friend that evangelicals could have ever had because, you know, it was a use situation. Donald Trump gave them three judges. He gave them over 200 judges that he appointed to the Supreme Court. And now we sit here watching about Roe versus Wade and maybe getting ready to go down for good. And that's what he did for them. He gave his base what they wanted. And, you know, I think it's kind of a horrible thing that maybe, you know, Democrats need to think about. Maybe you should give your base something, right? Maybe you should give your base something. But I digress. What is important about this, however, is to realize that what has happened with evangelicals is that it used to be that, oh, we don't want anybody who's morally, you know, bankrupt, right, or has moral issues. So if you think about, if we go back to moral majority and the
embrace. And that was Jerry Falwell.
Yeah, and
right?
Jerry Falwell. And the embrace of Ronald Reagan, where he says, you can't endorse me, but I endorse you. Right. Ronald Reagan was a divorcee. You know, evangelicals traditionally didn't like a divorce. They accepted him. And then, you know, the downward spiral goes until you get to Donald Trump, who's thrice married and, you know, had a very big event happen the month before the election about grabbing a woman's private parts. And they're like, OK, we're still going to vote for him. And voted for him in 2020, despite everything else. I mean, it didn't matter if he was sending kids, breaking up families. It did not matter what he did. They were still for him. And why were they? because he did for them what they have always wanted. And once people understand that this is a political thing and not a morality issue because they don't care about morality anymore, it becomes very clear that evangelicals are operating in a kind of political fashion as opposed to that.
And they got what they wanted, as you said, judges and justices.
Yeah.
You mentioned Ronald Reagan, and you also write in the book that, and as a reminder, he began his campaign in Philadelphia,
Mississippi,
not Pennsylvania, but Mississippi. What's the significance of that? What is the message that he was sending?
There was a message there. There was a two embedded message. If you know anything about history, Philadelphia, Mississippi, outside of there was where they found Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman murdered because they were down there registering people to vote back in 1964. Okay, so to start that campaign there, let them know two things. Number one, you know, I'm cool with this. And number two is I'm for states' rights. You can do whatever you want to do. States' rights is important. And so putting Ronald Reagan in that context and the evangelical embrace of him in the 1980s is a very clear signal about how they are beginning to change. It's just, they say they don't want it. You know, we want to change the culture. One of the things that evangelicals always want to talk about, we want to change the culture. Well, what happens when the culture changes you? Hmm. What happens when you become embedded in a culture that is political and racist? And that you embrace that, and that becomes, you know, goes into Christian Coalition, which was started by Pat Robertson. You have this whole thing. You have the ways in which Ken Starr went after Clinton, and we all know what happened there, you know, with him and Monica Lewinsky and how they went after Clinton on moral issues, right? I mean, you know, yeah, he lied. He did all this other stuff. That's bad, too. But they went after him in this moral way to try to show how their morality was better. You got George W., you know, W. Bush, who ended up, you know, maybe not really, you know, having won the election, but got put in by the Supreme Court, which, you know, is the beginning of a lot of electoral battles that we're still going to have to fight in 22 and 24. You know, and he should have been their exemplar of an evangelical president. But even then, that wasn't good enough for them. Hmm. They end up with Donald Trump, who, you know, is basically somebody who went to Norman Vincent Peale's church and believes in the power of positive thinking because he never says anything bad about himself. He's a prosperity gospel guy. And, you know, and that's who they embraced. And so even there, you can see the erosion of what evangelical religion has been that gets downgraded into sort of a prosperity gospel, you know, huckster kind of guy who can deliver for us.
Another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Anthea Butler. And we got a lot of comments here, which I will read after this short break. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and if you are just joining us, Anthea Butler is our guest. She's the Geraldine R. Siegel Professor of American Social Thought at the University of Pennsylvania, where she is Chair of Religious Studies. She's got a new book called White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America. Let me read some comments here. Patrick says, Trumpism has escalated racism and is destroying the fabric of American politics. I'll just leave that out there. Matt says, what is the connection between the Mormon church and the evangelical church? Can you answer that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting question. Mormons have kind of a similar history, but it's different because Mormons were trying to absolutely, you know, insert themselves into American society in a lot of different ways. But what we can see in the 1950s is that, you know, Mormon presidents are also, you know, sort of going after this. And I'm thinking about how, you know, you see pictures of them with JFK and others. They were doing sort of the same kinds of things. What becomes interesting to me is that Mormons also fall into this kind of moral sort of, you know, history in terms of thinking about morality. But they've also been locked out of evangelicalism because of their beliefs, except the moment in which they get acceptance is when, you know, and I think they haven't been accepted for a long time, but I think the political moment is this. When Romney is running against Obama in 2012 and the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association takes Mormonism off their cults list. Because that is the moment where they say, we need these votes. We don't need to think about them as cultic anymore. We need to think about them as fellow travelers in the gospel and fellow travelers in political activity, because they have the same kind of moral beliefs that we do. And so that moment to me back in October 2012 is a, you know, defining moment for how, you know, Mormons come into this whole sort of stream of evangelicalism. And so when you see them voting in the same kinds of ways that evangelicals did in 2016 and 2020, it's about shared ideals. And also, let's not forget this, because I think this is really important, shared ideas about capitalism, because that's the important part. And what I think people really also need to realize about evangelicals is that there is an apparatus behind all of this, whether that's focus on the family, Family Research Council, American Family Association, that raise millions of dollars every year and are able to lobby in D.C. and make sure that the kinds of things that they want to have happen, happen. And if you follow the money, then you follow the ways in which this movement has changed.
Here's a question from Luann. I know people with the evangelical movement that are uncomfortable with racist beliefs and with Trump. What is being done to mobilize that faction?
I think those people are mobilizing by, some of them are leaving. I think there's been some great articles in the New York Times and Washington Post about especially evangelicals of color who are leaving, you know, African-American evangelicals, Latinos and others who are leaving the movement and going out into different kinds of church and, you know, homes. The other part of this is that I think for a lot of white evangelicals, this is, you know, uncomfortable for them. And I would not dare to, you know, I would not say all evangelicals, right? But what I am saying is that the bulk of evangelicals who are espousing these kinds of political ideologies are the ones in which I think have caused the most harm. And so, you know, I have come to the conviction as a historian that maybe we have to use the term evangelical in different kinds of ways. Evangelicals don't like that, but I think they have to think about themselves as a religio-political movement as opposed to just being a religion. It's not just that anymore. And we can see this not just in America, but if you think about it in the ways in which it works in Brazil or Nigeria or in Russia or in, you know, in other places, then we can see how evangelicalism has taken a certain kind of conservative stance and instantiated itself in governments around the world.
You know, it's interesting. I was, you know, doing some digging in preparation for the show today, looking at rates of COVID and mask resistance and vaccine resistance. And you do see, you know, the more resistance, the higher rates of COVID tend to be in you know, more red states, I should say.
Yes.
And I'm assuming higher among white evangelicals.
Yes, definitely higher among white evangelicals. So let's go back to March 2020 and do a little quick history. Where a lot of evangelicals' church started about being, you know, against vaccines or against, you know, mandates or against masks and everything else was in a conversation about religious freedom. They were like, we want to be able to meet. We don't want to, you know, have to isolate. We need to meet for churches. Part of that is about practicality, but part of it is also about, guess what? No collections on Sunday, right? And so this became the tension. That was the beginning tension. Then when we all realized we needed to wear masks, it was opposing mask mandates. This is taking away my freedom. So these conversations about freedom get mixed in with God doesn't want you to cover your face, right? And you need to see your face and all of these things. And so now what you've got, you know, once we got to the vaccines, is that we don't want the vaccine. We don't know what that is. It's going to be the mark of the beast. Look, I'm, you know, all the QAnon stuff, you know, I'm magnetic, whatever the case may be. And now what we're faced with and what they are faced with is lots of their people are dying.
Yeah.
I've been tracking pastors who have died since this because they've either said they didn't want to. And they're also listening to these kinds of, I would say, you know, broadcasts that are telling them that this is not from God. I'm thinking of the guy over the Word Network, whose name I'm going to forget right now, who just died of COVID last month. They've been preaching against, you know, vaccination and selling all kinds of, you know, other remedies instead of just taking a shot. And this is where they have been detrimental to their own selves and their families.
Let me ask you about something else. And again, I'm back to the Pew Research, but they do some really interesting research looking at things like religion. About 3 in 10 Americans are religiously unaffiliated. Mm-hmm. I think they're called the N-O-N-E-S, the nuns. A 10% rise in the last decade. So when you look at evangelicals, and we are talking about white evangelicals today, you see those numbers shrinking. What does that tell us?
It tells us that the numbers are shrinking, but here's the interesting part. The numbers are shrinking in one way because the population is aging, right? And people are passing away, and younger people are not finding religious growth or happiness in these places, right? But I think the other thing that is interesting to watch is I would like to correlate this with the numbers of younger people who are embracing things like, Charlie Kirk's Turning Point and all of these things that have kind of an evangelical ethos to them, but they're not churches, but they're very political in terms of this. And this is where I think the ideas about Christian nationalism come in, because, we might not have, evangelicals might be declining, but I wonder how many Christian nationalists we have as compared to evangelicals right now. And I think that number probably is changing.
Here's someone who wants to know, why didn't Dr. Butler return to Catholicism? Are there similar racist beliefs in that Catholic church?
Well, this is where you've assumed that you don't know me, so I'm going to tell you something right now. Dr. Butler is a Catholic, and part of the reason why she is a Catholic and back in the mother church is because she likes to fight them too. So
you go to church to fight?
Well, I go to church to make sure that they stay right just like everybody else. And so,
how's that going for
you?
Well,
it's an uphill battle, let's put it like that. And, this is where I can talk about somebody like an Archbishop Gomez, who is over the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, who just, denounced, basically Black Lives Matter and said that that was a pseudo-religious movement. And I'm like, you are so wrong. You have messed up Catholic history. And this is where I think this is actually an interesting moment to talk about the ways in which Catholics and evangelicals have come together on a lot of these things. And that has also hardened Catholicism in America in such a way where we have this kind of ongoing battle between traditionalists who really don't see anything worthwhile in our current Pope, Pope Francis, and would like to believe that we should really still have the other Pope, right? Who is Pope, former Pope Benedict XVI. And, I'm in the Catholic Church for a couple of reasons. One is that's the baptism of my birth. But secondarily, it is a place in which I can exercise my intellectual capabilities in a way that
Do they want to hear what you have to say?
Well, they may not like what I have to say, but they don't tell me I can't say it.
Okay.
And there's a whole story, which someday I will write about myself, about my own, faith history and trajectory. But I think for people who are listening, you should understand that, the criticism that I think that evangelicals have wanted to say is that you don't know evangelicals. I'm like, I know you far too well. But I also know Catholics far too well, too. And I see where you're coming together, and I see where that is becoming a very big problem for us politically and socially.
Here's a related question from Lauren. I was raised in the evangelical church and switched to Catholicism as an adult. Why is there more of a tradition of social justice in the Catholic Church, despite all the corruption, and not in evangelicalism?
Because Catholics always had thought about what, Leonardo Boff called the preferential option for the poor. And that has been part of Catholic teaching. And so, when you start to think about poverty and you start to think about what you do, instead of putting that all together with capitalism, that makes it very different, right? And I think the other part of that is that, this is not this show, and I don't like to talk about scripture, but, Luke chapter 4 kind of puts it together for me. And that's where, Jesus says, I've come to, preach to the brokenhearted. I've come to do this stuff to set captives free. And if your faith is about, I've come to get rich and I've come to, live in a gated community and I've come so that my kids don't have to be in school with anybody that doesn't look any, that's dark skinned or from some other country or something, then you have to question yourself and figure out what that really means. And I think this is the battle for Catholics right now, is how do you forget that you have Dorothy Day and all of these other people who have been integral to thinking about what Catholic faith and tradition is, and throwing that away for some kind of political power. Right now we have 5 Catholic Supreme Court justices in there. I don't like 5 evangelical Supreme Court justices, but, I digress.
Well, and I want to digress a little bit and just go back a couple of decades to the Dixiecrats, because you and I have been critical of the Republican mm-hmm. Party and the sort of use, this sort of mixing of politics and religion. Yeah. But, before civil rights legislation, there were the Dixiecrats who were as racist as anybody.
Yeah, and Southern Baptists and everything else as everybody else, right? You know, and right there with the evangelicals. I mean, I think this is an interesting legacy for the Democratic Party, is that the Democrats have tried to change. But I find that there are Dixiecrat kinds of ways in which this pops up. Right now, this is going to really tear everybody up, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. Right now, the inability for our president to go forward and start to talk about voting rights in the way that he needs to sounds like to me a lot of obfuscation that happens. I mean, when I think about somebody like a Lyndon Baines Johnson, you know, President Johnson, who knew he had to get everybody in line and do this in 64 for the Voting Rights Act and does it, you know, because he sees the tide is turning. He's like, I got to do something because this is all becoming a mess. I find myself thinking about Democrats right now who don't really seem to care. They care more about their $12 ice cream. Oops, am I talking about somebody in, you know, who's maybe over, you know, the House of Representatives? $12 ice cream and, you know, nice statements are not going to cut it in 22 and 24. I think that if we're going to talk about this in terms of what's about to happen in 22 and 24, this kind of Dixiecrat sentiment for some of the Democratic Party right now about how they look at their, you know, most loyal constituents, which I'm saying African-American women who are churchgoers, who are, you know, faithful to the party and ignoring the kinds of things that need to happen right now, whether that's, you know, help for COVID-19, voting rights, you know, the kinds of assistance that people need, and trying to treat this as though they are, you know, going back to the same old party that they used to be. This is not going to work for them.
Let me read part of a comment from Timothy. He says, the history of racism or religious in religion isn't just about evangelicals. Evangelicals in the 19th century were abolitionists. There was a lot of debate within the evangelical conferences about whether politics should be part of church life. Those who thought it shouldn't be were almost always Southerners. They wanted to shut down the abolitionist streak, which was very wide in the evangelical movement.
Well, Timothy, I just want to thank you for buying the line that every evangelical historian wrote for you up to this moment.
Because they were not abolitionists?
Well, no, here's the thing. They were. But this is exactly what I talk about in the introduction to the book. I say evangelicals have written history about themselves. What the interesting part about evangelical history is that evangelical historians, white males mostly, up to the last 20 or 30 years, have been the ones that have written about this history. And they conveniently ignored slavery. They conveniently ignored, you know, the lost cause. They conveniently, you know, ignored a lot of things, right? And so while Timothy is correct, there's another history, Timothy, and I hope you pick up this book. Because what you need to do is read about the 200-plus history of evangelicals doing racist stuff that you don't want to admit to. It's a hard read. This is not an easy book. I will say this up front. It's not an easy book. It's not an easy book to write. You know, I don't hate evangelicals. But I wanted evangelicals to see their history cleanly and succinctly. And that's what this is about.
Let me just quote you at the very end. Evangelicalism is at a precipice. I mean, what do you see? Where is it going? And is it sort of blending into these right-wing political groups?
I see them becoming white Christian nationalists.
That's what you see?
Yeah. I mean, there were so many pastors.
Because that's where the power is?
Well, no, that's where the coalescence of all of their anxieties and fears and hatreds are. And that's the problem. The problem is, when I finished this last chapter of the book, it was July of 2020. And I could not have seen 1-6-2021 insurrection. I could not have seen that. I could not have seen them rolling up a crucifix alongside of a basically
gallows,
right? You know, I could not have imagined all of these people, you know, swarming the Capitol. I mean, we live in Philadelphia, which is, you know, sort of like the cradle of independence, right? And people have fought in the streets in Philadelphia. But to see them attacking the building in which our Congress and our Senate meet in the name of God and praying in the Senate chamber to talk about God being there, it's a desecration. Is a desecration. And these people were part of that desecration. And what I am asking evangelicals to consider is, are you going to be part of the desecration of this country that you claim to love? Are you going to be part of our destruction of democracy? Are you going to be complicit in the racism and the sexism and the homophobia and the absolute hatred of the other? That is what I am asking them to do. And they are hanging on by a thread.
Hmm. Email from Jane who says, yes, Dr. Butler. Dr. Butler, Anthea Butler, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And the book is called White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America. To replay this hour and many more, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs, or you can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at WHYY Radio Times. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us.